Americans prior to 1980-23. To put that more simply, a voter who mostly ignores American politics today is clearer on the differences between the two parties than political junkies and partisan loyalists were in 1980. That's an incredible ending. But it's also an obvious one. Voters, even inattentive ones, are seeing differences between the parties more clearly because those differences are bigger. It's easier to tell apart a donkey and an elephant than a donkey and a mule. As the parties' agendas have diverged, so, too, have the parties' views of each other. Earlier I mentioned the feelings thermometer results showing sharp drops in evaluations of the opposing party. That data, if anything, understates the change. Politics is driven by the most committed activists with the most intense opinions. And more telling than the drop in average assessments of the other party is the rise in panicked assessments of the other party. In 2014, Pew found that 37% of Republicans and 31% of Democrats viewed the other party as a threat to the nation's well-being. By 2016, that was up to 45% of Republicans and 41% of Democrats. 24. But that, too, makes perfect sense. If you're a Republican who believes the government spends too much on social programs, is too soft on unauthorized immigrants, and is too captured by radical environmentalists, the Democratic Party really has become scarier to you. If your concern with democratic governance hasn't risen over the past few decades, you haven't been paying attention. The question isn't why voters have become more reliably partisan as the parties have become more obviously deranged. Of course they did. It's why the parties have become so deranged. That's a story, as so many are in American life, that revolves around race. In her remarkable history of congressional violence, The Field of Blood, historian Joanne Freeman found that between 1830 and 1860, there were more than 70 violent incidents between congressmen in the House and Senate chambers or on nearby streets and dueling grounds. And she assures me this is a substantial undercount. 2. It would be reasonable to keep this warning in mind when you read the solutions found in the concluding chapter of this book. 3. It's important to note that not all political scientists agreed with this argument. J. Austin Rennie, for instance, published a prophetic dissent, arguing that unit, disciplined, and responsible parties are appropriate only to a government which seeks to locate full public power in the hands of popular majorities. America's political system, by contrast, was built to frustrate political majorities and required constant compromise. For that sort of system, Rennie said, polarized parties were quite inappropriate. He was right. For this speaks to perhaps the biggest chicken or the egg question in the polarization literature: are political elites polarizing and the public is simply following along? Is the public polarizing and political elites are responding? My synthesis, which will become clearer over the course of the book, is that everyone engaged in American politics is subject to the broader forces of polarization. The more engaged you are, the more polarized you become. So yes, political elites are polarizing more and faster than the public at large, but as the public tunes in, it becomes more polarized, too. And since politicians are most responsive to the part of the public that is most polarized, we're all living in a hyper-polarized system and being faced with polarizing choices, whatever our personal level of polarization. V. Like the now controversial individual mandate. More on that later. Chapter 2. The Dixiecrat Dilemma. On Wednesday, August 28, 1957, during the Senate's consideration of a watered-down civil rights bill, Strom Thurmond walked onto the Senate floor and kicked the most famous lie buster in American history. He began by reading the election statutes of all 48 states. Then he read the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, George Washington's farewell address, and much else besides. He got one bathroom break, when Barry Goldwater took the oar on his behalf. He ate cold sirloin steak and pumpernickel bread his wife had packed him and sucked on throat lozenges. At times, his voice became too weak to hear. He nished 24 hours and 18 minutes later by saying he intended to vote against the legislation. His annoyed and exhausted colleagues were not surprised. Thurmond's lie buster was the longest in American history. It lls 96 pages in the Congressional Record. It was also one of the least effective. As Joseph Crispino recounts in Strom Thurmond's America, Southern senators had spent months gutting the bill. They killed Section 3, which permitted the Attorney General to bring lawsuits against discrimination in public areas. They kneecapped the voting rights provisions by guaranteeing a jury trial in cases of voter obstruction. No Southern jury would ever convict a white election official for stopping African Americans from voting. Thurmond himself celebrated the achievements. He said they'd pulled the most venomous teeth from the so-called civil rights bill, and he praised Democratic Senators Richard Russell and Lyndon Johnson, the leaders of the EORT, for a magnificent job. Then he decided to make their job harder. The deal Russell and Johnson had cut was that if Republicans and moderate Democrats allowed them to weaken the legislation, they would persuade their fellow Southerners to permit it to pass. In the clubby Senate of the 1950s, word was bond. Keeping your end of the deal was necessary to being able to make any future pacts. If Southerners killed the bill, a Johnson staer warned, the South could lose not only the ability to have any impact on civil rights legislation but any influence it has in Congress at all. So the Southern senators agreed, there would be no liebuster. Time magazine reported that Thurmond was among the RST to agree with the non-liebuster decision one, but then the telegrams and the letters from outraged segregationists began. Thurmond asked Russell to reconsider an organized liebuster. Russell refused. So Thurmond liebustered on his own. He didn't imperil the bill, but he made his fellow Southerners look bad. They were keeping quiet in order to sustain segregation. He went loud to further his career. He made it seem like he was the only senator with the courage to speak out and defend the South's racial hierarchy. Oh God, the venomous hatred of his Southern colleagues, recalled an aide to Johnson. The courtly Russell condemned Thurmond's liebuster as an act of personal political aggrandizement. The bill passed over Thurmond's objections. The solitary, arguably counterproductive stand against the civil rights bill is Thurmond's most famous liebuster, but not his most consequential. That came in 1965, after President Johnson won re-election in a landslide and Democrats managed a remarkable two-thirds majority in the Senate. Democrats saw an opportunity to shore themselves up for decades by eliminating the Taft-Hartley provision that permits state right-to-work laws, which cripple organized labor's ability to unionize workplaces. If the bill passed, unions, freed from their most binding constraint, could organize more workers and muster more votes for Democrats. It was supposed to be easy. With 68 Democrats in the Senate, everything was supposed to be easy. But Thurmond led a group of Southern Democrats and conservative Republicans in a business-backed liebuster of the legislation. That time, his liebuster lasted barely more than VE hours. But then, it didn't have to be any longer. Unlike Thurmond's liebuster of the civil rights bill, this time he had allies enough of them to kill legislation that otherwise would have passed. That liebuster drove a sharp nail deep into Labor's CON and weakened the Democratic Party. Thurmond typically received a zero on the Americans for Democratic Action scorecard, which is a rough measure of how liberal a senator is. He was Republican President Dwight Eisenhower's second most reliable ally in the Senate. He was one of Goldwater's closest Confederates. Thurmond wasn't just a conservative on race. As his anti-labor liebuster suggests, he was a conservative on everything. Crispino argues, convincingly, that Thurmond should be seen as a forefather of modern conservatism. In 1948, when Goldwater was still a year away from running for the Phoenix City Council and Reagan was still an actor, Thurmond was a presidential candidate denouncing federal meddling in private business, the growing socialist impulse in American politics, and the dangers of statism, he writes. But until a few months prior to that 1965 liebuster, Thurmond had been a Democrat. He was elected to the Senate as a Democrat in 1954, and he wouldn't switch to the Republican Party until 1964. Thurmond's politics and path are America's 20th century political realignment in miniature. To understand what happened in American politics between 1950 and 2018, you need to understand what the Southern Democratic Party was and what it became. As the famed political scientist V. Oki Jr. observed, the South's Democratic Party was an institution unto itself. Within the South, the Democratic Party is no party at all but a multiplicity of factions struggling for OCE2. It had liberals and conservatives, machine politicians and reformers. In national politics, however, the South's Democratic Party was a united front, the instrument for the conduct of the foreign relations of the South with the rest of the nation. That the South felt it needed something akin to a diplomatic strategy with the rest of America is little surprise. The Civil War was only 100 years in the past at the time the Civil Rights Act passed, and during that interregnum, the White South had been trying to balance its top domestic priority, the enforcement of white supremacy, held in place by the dual weapons of law and violence, with its forced membership in the broader United States. The Southern Democratic Party was the vehicle through which the White South negotiated that tension. Put simply, the Southern Democratic Party was an authoritarian institution that ruled autocratically in the South and that protected its autonomy by entering into a governing coalition with the National Democratic Party. The Dixiecrats gave the National Democrats the votes they needed to control Congress, and the National Democrats let the Dixiecrats enforce segregation and one-party rule at home. The Dixiecrat-Democrat Pact is a powerful reminder that there are worse things than polarization, that what's now remembered as a golden age in American politics was purchased at a terrible cost. In his book Paths Out of Dixie, The Democratization of Authoritarian Enclaves in America's Deep South, Robert Mickey argues, in the 1890s leaders of the 11 states of the old Confederacy founded stable, one-party authoritarian enclaves under the Democratic banner. Having secured a conditional autonomy from the central state and the national party, these rulers curtailed electorates, harassed and repressed opposition parties, and created and regulated racially separate and significantly unfree civic spheres. State-sponsored violence enforced these elements in a system that ensured cheap agricultural labor and white supremacy. 3. If it is strange to read about America in the language we often use to write about, say, post-Soviet republics, well, that's partly the point. America is aspirational, says Carol Anderson, the author of White Rage and a professor of African American Studies at Emory University. That is part of what sets it apart. Marginalized people have used those aspirations to say, this is what you say you are, but this is what you do. But what also happens is those aspirations get encoded as achievements. You get this longing for a mythical past. For demythologizing our past is necessary if we are to clearly understand our present. But an honest survey of America's past upends the story we tell ourselves. It upends our sense of America as a true democracy and the Democratic Party's sense of its own honorable history. The reign of the Dixiecrats during much of the 20th century, the Democratic Party's rule in the South was hegemonic. At times, Democrats occupied a stunning 95% of all elected OCES, and as is true with authoritarian rulers everywhere, they did so in part by suppressing free and fair elections. African American voters were legally barred from voting in many cases and, when that didn't work, beaten or even killed for trying to exercise the franchise. During his 1946 re-election campaign, Democratic Senator Theodore Bilbo was chillingly blunt, "You and I know what's the best way to keep the nigger from voting. You do it the night before the election. I don't have to tell you any more than that. Red-blooded men know what I mean." 5. He won the race. A group of FTY Mississippians argued that Bilbo shouldn't be seated because he'd used the threat of violence to keep African Americans from the polls. The Senate convened a committee of 2 Republicans and 3 Southern Democrats to hear testimony, but on a party-line vote, the Democrats overruled Bilbo's election. Any difficulties experienced by the Negro in his attempts to register and vote in the July 2 primary resulted from the traditional feeling between white and Negroes and their ideas of the laws in that state as regards participation by Negroes in the Democratic primaries, read the majority's opinion, and it would have been the same irrespective of who the candidates might have been. 6. The South's mixture of legal discrimination and racial terrorism worked. Within 3 years of the Civil War's end, Black voter registration ranged from 85 to 94% in the Deep South, and almost 1 million freedmen were voting throughout the region, 7 records Mickey. Less than a century later, that fundamental freedom had been demolished. By 1944, in the states of the old Confederacy, only 5% of age-eligible African Americans were registered to vote, which left millions of blacks politically voiceless, writes Anderson. The repression was acutest where black political power was most feared. In 1953, in the so-called Black Belt, the region of Alabama where the black population exceeded the white population, only 1.3% of eligible African Americans were registered. Two counties had no black voters whatsoever. 8. There was violence here, and even attempted coups, as when members of Louisiana's White League stormed New Orleans in 1874, trying to eject Governor William Kellogg, a Republican, and install his unsuccessful Democratic challenger, John McHenry. The insurgents took control of the city, forcing President Ulysses S. Grant to send in federal troops to restore order. In a telling postscript, a monument was erected in New Orleans in 1891 memorializing the White League members who died trying to take over the city. It was nearly pulled down in 2017. While some have driven by these monuments every day and either revered their beauty or failed to see them at all, many of our neighbors and fellow Americans see them very clearly, said New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu in a speech explaining his decision to remove the city's monuments to the Confederacy. Many are painfully aware of the long shadows their presence casts, not only literally but figuratively. And they clearly receive the message that the Confederacy and the cult of the lost cause intended to deliver. As the New Orleans coup suggests, the Democratic Party enforced one-party rule by crushing white Republicans, too. Democrats controlled all election laws and election administration, and they took care to keep barriers to entry of potential opponents prohibitively high, writes Mickey. Several states, by party rule or statute, barred previously disloyal candidates, or those who failed to pledge themselves to the values of the Democratic Party, from running for OCE even as independents. 9. And thus the Southern Democratic Party succeeded in consolidating authoritarian control over the Deep South. The question is why the rest of the country, a country that was, imperfectly but undeniably, operating under a liberal democratic system, permitted the South to make such a mockery of America's political values. Part of the answer lies in the path chosen in the aftermath of the Civil War, when President Andrew Johnson, a bitter white supremacist, abandoned the work of racial equality and restored the South to white control. In a fusillade against the Reconstruction Acts passed by Congress, Johnson warned they would allow black people to rule the white race, make and administer state laws, elect presidents and members of Congress, and shape to a greater or lesser extent the future destiny of the whole country. Would such a trust and power be safe in such hands? 10. The restoration of what was, in EECT, the Confederate political hierarchy in the South set the country on a path that paired the power of white supremacy with the power of political transactionalism. Even when National Democrats weren't led by revanchist racists, the South was left to the warlords for the same reason territories are often left to warlords: it served the interests of those in power. National Democrats cared about passing the New Deal, about winning presidential elections, about building infrastructure projects. Given the choice between working with a Southern Democratic Party that could provide them crucial votes or challenging a Southern Democratic Party that could defect and doom the Democratic Party's national agenda, they chose accommodation. Moreover, the Dixiecrats' total domination of the South gave them the numbers to dominate the National Democratic Party, too. From 1896 to 1932, Southerners made up two-thirds of the Democratic House Caucus. From 1933 to 1953, their share never slipped below 40%, writes Mickey. 11. These gurus, if anything, underestimate the South's political clout. In the U.S. Congress of that era, seniority meant power. And because of the authoritarian structure Southern Democrats operated at home, they were rarely exposed to anything even approaching electoral pressure, which let them amass more seniority, in greater numbers, than elected O'Chales of any other region. As Columbia University historian Ira Katz Nelson writes in Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time, in 1933, Southerners chaired 29 of the 47 committees in the House, including appropriations, banking and currency, judiciary, foreign affairs, agriculture, military heirs and ways and means. They also, crucially, dominated the Rules Committee, which controlled what legislation made it to the House or and under what conditions. In the Senate, Southerners helmed 13 of 33 committees, including agriculture, appropriations, banking and currency, commerce, finance, and military heirs 12. The leverage this gave the region over Congress was near total. It's not just that most Sinecant bills were at least partly under the jurisdiction of one of these committees. It's that every single senator had interests that ran through these committees. A northern liberal who didn't care all that much about race but cared deeply about health care needed to work with the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and that was going to be hard to do if he'd infuriated the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee by taking aim at civil rights, the single thing he, and all his southern colleagues, cared about above all others. This power brought presidents to heel as surely as it did wayward congressmen. Faced with anti-lynching legislation in the late 1930s, President Franklin D. Roosevelt said that if he supported it, Southern committee chairs would block every bill I ask Congress to pass to keep America from collapsing. 13. Moreover, if you weren't acceptable to Southern Democrats, you weren't going to be the Democrats' nominee for president in the RST place. The party required a two-thirds supermajority of delegates to the National Convention to approve a presidential ticket, which meant the South held an eictive veto over a hostile nominee. At the same time, the South's alliance with the Democratic Party was by no means purely cynical. They really were Democrats, their party loyalty locked in place by regional identity and interest. Abraham Lincoln was the RST Republican president, the South's enmity toward the Republican Party was thus signed in blood. The Democratic Party supported redistribution from the rich to the poor, and the North was rich and the South was poor. Around the turn of the 20th century, the Southern Democrats represented the left wing of the Democratic Party, says Princeton University professor Howard Rosenthal. They were basically populist. The questions of redistribution at that time were from a relatively well-off North to a poor South. Race was not on the table as an area of disagreement in Congress. But then race became an area of disagreement. Democrats didn't just want to redistribute from rich northern whites to poor southern whites. They also wanted to redistribute from richer whites to poorer blacks. Furthermore, beginning in 1948, with President Harry Truman's military desegregation orders, the Democratic Party became a vehicle for civil rights, betraying its fundamental compact with the South. It's in this era that a Republican, Barry Goldwater, running on a platform of states' rights, carried much of the old Confederacy in a presidential election for the RST time. The story of how the Democratic Party came to embrace civil rights is complex. It includes the idealism of politicians like Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey, as well as the hard math of electoral coalitions that, particularly in the North, began to include non-white voters. It re-ex the logical endpoint of economic progressivism, as attention to the poor demanded attention to what was keeping so many non-white Americans poor, and it re-acted strategic decisions the Republican Party made along the way, particularly the conservative movement's successful effort to turn the GOP into an ideological vehicle denied by mistrust of the federal government, opposition to redistribution, and faith in state and local rule, attractive ideas for Southerners looking to block national efforts to improve both the economic and political conditions of African Americans. Still, at the moment of rupture, the parties remained blurred. It is remarkable, from our current vantage point where everything cuts red from blue, to see a debate that polarizes the country without splitting the parties. But that was the case with the 1964 Civil Rights Act. As Geo Ray Cabas Service shows in Rule and Ruin, his history of Republican moderation, 80% of House Republicans supported the bill, as opposed to 60% of House Democrats. 14. In the Senate, the Judiciary Committee was helmed by Mississippi's James Eastland, a dead end for the bill. So rather than going through a normal committee process, the legislation was worked out between President Johnson and Everett Dirksen, the Illinois Republican who served as minority leader. Southern Democrats lie-bustered the bill, but Dirksen corralled 27 of the 33 Republicans to break the lie-buster. In the end, as with the House vote, a greater proportion of Senate Republicans than Democrats voted for cloture and passage of the Civil Rights Act, more than 4/3 of the Republicans but only some 2/3 of the Democrats, wrote Kaba Service. So why are the Democrats seen as the party that passed the Civil Rights Act? There, the answer is simple. Because they were the party that passed the Civil Rights Act. They held the majority in both chambers and the presidency. They chose to snap their alliance with the Dixiecrats to pursue justice. Bill Moyers, who served as special assistant to Johnson, recalls ending the president brooding in his bedroom the night he signed the Civil Rights Act. "I think we just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come," Moyers remembers Johnson saying. 15. Johnson, who as Senate Majority Leader had enforced the Southern Democrats' blockage against racial equality, was right. The Democratic Party's hammerlock on the South took time to break, but that was the moment it began to weaken. So why didn't Republicans become the party of civil rights? Largely, Kaba Service argues, because of Goldwater, the credit, even the glory that the Republican Party should have enjoyed for its support for the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was effectively negated when its presumptive presidential nominee voted against the measure. And sure enough, Goldwater's stance against civil rights paid dividends. His disastrous presidential campaign succeeded in only one region of the country, the old Confederacy, which realized that the language of small government conservatism could be weaponized against the federal government's efforts to right America's racial wrongs. That, then, is the story of the long period of depolarization in American politics. The South was in the Democratic Party, but it didn't agree with the Democratic Party, particularly once liberalism's vision of redistribution and uplift expanded to include African Americans. So Southern Democrats had ideological reasons to compromise with Republicans but political reasons to compromise with National Democrats. Southern power kept the Democratic Party less liberal than it otherwise would have been, the Republican Party congressionally weaker than it otherwise would have been, and stopped the two parties from sorting themselves around the deepest political cleavage of the age. Here, you can see the power and purpose of ticket splitting in an era of mixed parties. Southern Democrats could vote for a Republican for president and conservative Dixiecrat Democrats for Congress and governorships. It is not that American politics was not riven by sharp, even violent disagreement in this era, it's simply that these GHTs did not map cleanly onto party. It couldn't last, and it didn't. The Democratic Party's embrace of civil rights, and the Republican Party's decision to unite behind a standard-bearer who opposed the bill, cleared the way for Southern conservatives to join the Republican Party. And that set the stage for all that followed. Polarization is not extremism, but it is sorting. Before we get to all that followed, I want to say a word about what polarization is and isn't. There's a long-running debate among political scientists about whether America is polarizing or just sorting. There's also a long-running public discourse in which polarized or partisan is used as a synonym for extreme. For the sake of clarity, I want to address both. Let's start with polarization versus sorting, using cannabis policy as an example. Imagine a 100-person America, where 40 people want cannabis outlawed, 40 want it legalized, and 20 aren't sure. If the Democratic and Republican parties ND themselves with an equal number of members from each group, America is totally unsorted. Now imagine that everyone who wants to legalize cannabis moves into the Democratic Party, everyone who wants to outlaw it joins the Republican Party, and the undecided voters are split evenly between the two parties. Now the parties are perfectly sorted, but, and this is the crucial point, no one's opinion has actually changed. The country holds the same mix of beliefs about pot in both examples. It's just that in the second example, those beliefs are sorted by party. So that's sorting. Now let's tweak the example again. Imagine the undecideds make up their minds. Now FTY Americans want to legalize cannabis and FTY want to outlaw it. That's polarization, the opinions themselves change to cluster around two poles, with no one left in the middle. The Georgetown University political scientist Hans Noel says that sorting is just a subcategory of polarization. 16. In practical terms, he writes, both of these have the consequence of increasing the tension between the two ends of the spectrum, which is what polarization is meant to describe. I agree with Noel and would take it a step further. The polarization versus sorting debate is better understood as describing issue-based polarization and identity-based polarization. Both cannabis examples show people clustering around poles. It's just that in one example, the poles that they're clustering around re-ect their policy opinions, while in the other, the poles they're clustering around re-ect their political identities. Crucially, these forms of polarization reinforce each other. Issue-based polarization leads to political identity polarization. If there's more intense disagreement about cannabis policy, people will want their political representatives to GHT for their beliefs, which will push the parties to polarize around the issue as well. You can argue that that's what happened in the civil rights example above, as intense polarization around the issue of civil rights drove party polarization around civil rights. The Goldwater campaign tried to seize political opportunity by providing a home to angry racial conservatives, which eventually led those racial conservatives to cluster in the Republican Party, and vice versa. The reverse, of course, is also true. When people sort their disagreements by party, that can lead those disagreements to deepen. If people sort into two parties along the axis of their ideal marijuana policy, those two parties will OER increasingly clear positions on marijuana, and the undecided will be pushed to make a choice, thus further polarizing the country's beliefs about cannabis. Polarization begets polarization. But it doesn't beget extremism. We often assume that voters and political systems that split the adherents are less extreme than those that don't, but this idea proves incoherent upon a moment's inspection. In 1965, most Senate Republicans joined with the Democratic Party to create Medicare, a single-payer healthcare system for the elderly. In 2010, not a single congressional Republican voted for Obamacare, a healthcare plan based on the system Republican Governor Mitt Romney designed in Massachusetts. Under any definition, the 2010 system was more sorted and polarized than the 1965 system. Opinions were better aligned by party, and fewer politicians found themselves in the middle. But was the 2010 system more ideologically extreme? I'd argue, under our normal ideological definitions, it wasn't. Obamacare was a public-private system with Republican roots that paid for itself through a mixture of tax increases and spending cuts, while Medicare was a liberal government takeover of healthcare for the elderly that created an open-ended entitlement with no dedicated way to pay its full costs. And that's assuming ideological extremism is an idea with internal logic in the RST place, which I also doubt. What makes a national, government-run healthcare system more extreme than a mixed system that leaves tens of millions of people uninsured? The former is treated as more radical within the conness of American politics, but it's the latter that's radical, and cruel, when judged by the standards of other developed nations. Or, to go back to the main story of this chapter, in the era when Washington was least polarized, political consensus rested on a foundation of racial bigotry that most would end abhorrent today. The compromises Congress made to preserve the peace included voting down anti-lynching laws and agreeing to lock most African Americans out of Social Security. I would call that political system far more ideologically extreme than the one we have today, even as it was less polarized. Political scientists agree that the mid-20th century was the low ebb of political polarization, particularly in Congress. But the mid-20th century was not an era in which the world outside Washington was either serene or moderate. This was the age of Joseph McCarthy, the Vietnam War, and the draft dodger. It was a time of political assassinations, of civil rights activists being beaten on bridges, of authoritarian rule in the South, of feminists marching in the streets and Native Americans occupying Alcatraz. The irony is that the American political system was most calm and least polarized when America itself seemed to be on the verge of cracking apart. You'll often hear pundits talk about the moderate majority. But as the political scientist David Brokman has shown, these so-called moderates tend to hold more extreme opinions than liberals or conservatives. The way it works is that a pollster will ask people for their position on a wide range of issues: marijuana legalization, the war in Iraq, universal health care, gay marriage, taxes, climate change, and so on. The answers will then be coded as to whether they're left or right. People who have a mix of answers on the left and the right average out to the middle and they're labeled as moderate. But they're not moderate. They're just internally unsorted. When you drill down into those individual answers, you end a lot of opinions that are well out of the political mainstream. A lot of people say we should have a universal healthcare system run by the state like the British, Brokman told me. A lot of people say we should deport all undocumented immigrants immediately with no due process. You'll often see really draconian measures towards gays and lesbians get 16-20% support. These people look like moderates, but they're actually quite extreme. 17. When polarization is driven by allegiance to political parties, it can be moderating. Political parties want to win elections, so they try to champion ideas that won't get their candidates crushed at the ballot box. People who aren't attached to one party or the other are free to hold much more unpopular opinions. Extremism is a value judgment. To early 20th century Americans, our widespread acceptance of interracial and gay marriage would be extreme. To many of us, the ideological consensus that kept consenting adults of different races or the same gender from living happy, loving lives together seems vicious and ignorant. Today, vegans are dismissed as extremists. I hope that in the future, the slaughtering that we impose on animals through industrial-scale factory farming is considered the shocking position. When I say the political coalitions are becoming more sorted and more polarized, I mean only that there is less ideological overlap, fewer of us are caught in the middle, and there is more tension between the poles. Nothing about those dynamics makes the opinions partisans hold in 2020 more extreme than those held by their forebears. Banal views held widely in that era would get you run out of polite society today, and rightly so. That said, if the degree of extremism in our politics is often overstated, the stunning comprehensiveness with which we've sorted and polarized ourselves is often understated, as are its implications for our future. One Nation, sorted. The passage of the Civil Rights Act heralded the death of the Dixiecrats. The death of the Dixiecrats cleared the way for Southern conservatives to join the Republican Party and Northern liberals to join the Democratic Party. That let the parties sort themselves ideologically, such that there are no longer any House Democrats more conservative than any House Republicans or any House Republicans more liberal than any House Democrats. And with that essential clarity, the parties sorted around virtually everything else, too. This transformation has taken the two parties from being coalitions that looked alike, lived similar lives, and thought only somewhat differently to two warring camps that look different, live different, lives in different places, and end themselves in ever deeper disagreement. In her book Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity, political scientist Liliana Mason offers a stunning overview of the way the parties have changed in recent years. Back in 1952, she writes, the demographic differences between the parties were modest, with the exception of Southerners, who, as we've seen, were Democratic, and Protestants, who leaned Republican. No major demographic group saw more than a 10 percentage point difference. Indiana, the percentage of its members represented within each party 18, so the Democratic and Republican parties looked reasonably similar in their representation of African Americans and whites, of men and women, of married and unmarried voters. Even liberals were only slightly more populous in the Democratic Party. That is, to put it gently, no longer true. In the 1952 presidential election, the American National Election Survey found that 6% of self-identified Democrats and 2% of self-identified Republicans were non-white. In 2012, the same survey found 43% of self-identified Democrats, but only 9% of self-identified Republicans, were non-white. 19. So not only was the 2012 electorate far more racially diverse than the 1952 electorate, but that diversity was concentrated in the Democratic Party. The religious divide is similarly stark. In 2014, Pew reported that the single largest religious group in the Republican coalition was evangelical Protestants. And the Democrats? Their single largest religious group was the religiously unaffiliated, the knowns. 20. As demographics change, so do values. In 2002, 50% of Republicans and 52% of Democrats said it wasn't necessary to believe in God to be a moral person. By 2017, the number of Republicans agreeing with that statement had fallen slightly, to 47%, while the number of Democrats agreeing had shot up to 64%. 21 As Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt wrote in How Democracies Die, the two parties are now divided over race and religion, two deeply polarizing issues that tend to generate greater intolerance and hostility than traditional policy issues such as taxes and government spending. I'd amend that slightly. The parties are dividing over fundamental identities that tend to generate intolerance and hostility, and the issue conists are just one expression of that division. But it isn't just race and religion. We are sorted by geography, too. In his book The Great Alignment, Race, Party Transformation, and the Rise of Donald Trump, Abramovitz conducts an analysis I found shocking. Looking back over decades of presidential elections, he shows that for much of the 20th century, the idea of red states and blue states wouldn't have made much sense. There was very little relationship, for instance, between the pattern of support for George McGovern, a strong liberal from South Dakota, in 1972, and the pattern of support just 4 years later for Jimmy Carter, a moderate from Georgia, he writes. 22 The numbers here are stunning. From 1972 to 1984, the average difference between how a state voted in one presidential election and how it voted in the next was 7.7 percentage points. From 2000 to 2012, it was only 1.9 percentage points. We are XED in political place. The sorting continues far beneath the state level. In an analysis at 538, Dave Wasserman looked at landslide counties, counties where the winning presidential candidate got at least 60% of the vote. In 1992, 39% of voters lived in landslide counties. By 2016, that had shot to 61% of voters. The numbers were even starker when Wasserman looked at counties where the winning candidate won by more than 50 points, the share of voters living in those extreme landslide counties more than quintupled, from 4% in 1992 to 21% in 2016. In less than 20 years, the percentage of voters who lived in a district where almost everyone thought like them politically went from 1 in 20 to 1 in 5. You could imagine a world where this data said little about the kinds of places people lived. Yes, we were more sorted politically, but those sorted spaces were randomly distributed across the country's geography. That's not the world we live in. Tucked inside these numbers is a growing urban-rural divide. There is no dense city in America that routinely votes Republican. There are few rural areas that vote Democratic. Mark Morrow, the policy director at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, calculates that the dividing line is at about 900 people per square mile. Above that, areas trend Democratic, below it, they turn Republican. 23 decades ago, when the parties were less sorted, the density of the place we lived did less to predict our partisanship. Today, as political scientist Jonathan Rodden shows in his book Why Cities Lose, the density of the place we live has become a powerful predictor of partisanship. Call this the tale of two Clintons. As the political analyst Ron Brownstein wrote in The Atlantic, in both 1992 and 1996, Bill Clinton carried nearly half of America's 3,100 counties. But since then, Democrats have retreated into the nation's urban centers. 24 In 2000, Al Gore won the popular vote with fewer than 700 counties. In 2012, Obama won the popular vote by much more than Gore, but carried only about 600 counties. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote with fewer than 100 counties, more than 1,000 counties fewer than her husband had won 20 years before. What makes America's urban-rural divide particularly destabilizing is the economic divide it tracks. At a March 2018 conference in India, Hillary Clinton set off a political ruckus by saying, "I won the places that represent two-thirds of America's gross domestic product. So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward." 25 Putting aside the propriety of Clinton's comment, the data is solid. It comes from a Brookings report that found that the less than 500 counties that Hillary Clinton carried nationwide encompassed a massive 64% of America's economic activity as measured by total output in 2015-26 as a comparison. The counties Gore won in 2000 accounted for 54% of total GDP. The differences we can measure hide the differences we can't measure, or haven't thought to measure. In The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart, Bill Bishop writes eloquently of the dizzying array of factors that drive where we live. Between 4 and 5% of the population moves each year from one county to another. 100 million Americans in the past decade. They are moving to take jobs, to be close to family, or to follow the sun. When they look for a place to live, they run through a checklist of amenities. Is there the right kind of church nearby? The right kind of COEE shop? How close is the neighborhood to the center of the city? What are the rents? Is the place safe? When people move, they also make choices about who their neighbors will be and who will share their new lives. Point 27. All these choices and factors connect to our political dispositions and identities. After the 2018 election, for instance, Wasserman calculated that House Democrats now represented 78% of all Whole Foods locations, but only 27% of Cracker Barrels. In theory, there is nothing about organic apples or all-day WAES that should predict our politics, but our identities and preferences layer atop each other in complex ways. Point 28. It's easy to overstate the direct role partisanship is playing in these decisions. While it's true that Democrats prefer to live among Democrats and Republicans like living among Republicans, research shows that the dominant considerations when people are choosing a place to move are housing prices, school quality, crime rates, and similar quality of life questions. Point 29. However, the big driver here isn't the small moves people make between communities, but the big decision they make or that their parents, or their parents' parents, made to live in an urban or rural area. As the parties become more racially, religiously, ideologically, and geographically different, the signals that tell us if a place is our kind of place, if a community is our kind of community, heighten our political divisions. The more sorted we are in our differences, the more different we grow in our preferences. In 2017, Pew found that most Republicans, 65%, say they would rather live in a community where houses are larger and farther apart and where schools and shopping are not nearby. A majority of Democrats, 61%, prefer smaller houses within walking distance of schools and shopping. 30. Thus, a preference that seems non-political on its face. I want a big house with a yard, or I want to live in a diverse city with lots of new restaurants becomes yet another force pulling partisans away from each other. There's a reason these divides are all stacking on top of one another. They don't merely track differences in our politics. They track differences in our psychologies. The psychological roots of our politics. Let's start with the obvious. People are different. My older brother is a social animal, eager to make small talk, able to forge connections with strangers in seconds. I stand in the corner at cocktail parties, uncomfortable with people I don't already know well. My younger sister is a talented artist who designs jewelry and has been making psychedelic art since she was 6. I have such bad penmanship that I started a course to improve my handwriting in my 30s, and if you ask me to sketch a person, I'll plop a small circle for a head over a fatter circle for a body, like a 6-year-old who just learned to draw. As a result, my brother, who likes socializing more than I do, does more socializing. My sister, with her talent for art, makes more art. Some of these differences are rooted in nurture, in experience. But others are evident from our earliest days. Psychologists speak of the big 5 personality traits: openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion-introversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. Where we fall on these scales is measurable in childhood and shapes our lives thereafter. It affects where we live, what we like, who we love. And, increasingly, it shapes our politics. In their book Open vs. Closed, Personality, Identity, and the Politics of Redistribution, political psychologists Christopher Johnston, Christopher Federico, and Howard Levine write that Democrats and Republicans are now sharply distinguished by a set of basic psychological dispositions related to experiential openness, a general dimension of personality tapping tolerance for threat and uncertainty in one's environment. 31. A similar argument, using slightly different data, can be found in political scientists Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler's Prius or Pickup. How the answers to four simple questions explain America's great divide. Of the many factors that make up your worldview, one is more fundamental than any other in determining which side of the divide you gravitate toward, your perception of how dangerous the world is. Fear is perhaps our most primal instinct, after all, so it's only logical that people's level of fearfulness informs their outlook on life. 32 Dierent studies categorize people in Dierent ways, but the common thread is that openness to experience and the basic optimism that drives it is associated with liberalism, while conscientiousness, a preference for order and tradition that breeds a skepticism toward disruptive change, connects to conservatism. People high in openness are more likely to enjoy trying new foods, traveling to new places, living in diverse cities, keeping a messy desk. They're less sensitive to threatening photos and disgusting images, even when measuring subrational indicators like eye tracking and saliva chemicals. In predisposed, liberals, conservatives, and the biology of political dierences, John Hibbing, Kevin Smith, and John Alfred Wright, numerous studies have linked these personality dimensions to dierences in the mix of tastes and preferences that seem to reliably separate liberals and conservatives. People who score high on openness, for example, tend to like envelope-pushing music and abstract art. People who score high on conscientiousness are more likely to be organized, faithful, and loyal. One review of this large research literature NDS these sorts of dierences consistently cropping up across nearly 70 years of studies on personality research. The punchline, of course, is that this same literature also reports a consistent relationship between these dimensions of personality and political temperament. Those open to new experiences are not just hanging Jackson Pollock prints in disorganized bedrooms while listening to techno-pop reinterpretations of Bach by experimental jazz bands. They are also more likely to identify themselves as liberals. 33 This is why Whole Foods and Cracker Barrel locations track deep partisan divisions. Whole Foods is a grocer catering to those high in openness to experience. The aisles are thick with ethnic foods, unusual produce, and magazines touting Eastern spirituality. Cracker Barrel, by contrast, is aimed at those preferring tradition, i.e. comforting, Southern favorites that are delicious without being surprising. These are large corporations with skilled teams that carefully choose the placements of new locations. Their choices map onto our politics not because they are trying to serve one side of the political divide but because our politics map onto our deeper preferences, and those deeper preferences drive much more than just our politics. We like to think that we choose our politics by slowly, methodically developing a worldview, using that worldview to generate conclusions about ideal tax and health and foreign policy, and then selecting the political party that ts best. That's not how the political psychologists see it. They argue that our politics, much like our interest in travel and spicy food and being in crowds, emerges from our psychological makeup. Certain ideas are attractive to some people and repulsive to others, and that means, essentially, that ideologies and psychologies are magnetically drawn to each other, 34 says John Jost, a political psychologist at New York University. When Obama paired the words hope and change, he was expressing something fundamental to the liberal psychology. Change makes some fearful, but within the liberal temperament, it carries the hope of something better. The kinds of people most attracted to liberalism are the kinds of people who are excited by change, by dierents, by diversity. Their politics are just one expression of that basic temperament, a temperament that might push them to live in polyglot cities, to hitchhike across Europe, to watch foreign language LMS. By contrast, the job of the conservative, wrote National Review founder William F. Buckley, is to stand athwart history, yelling stop. 35 You can see how that might appeal to a person who mistrusts change, appreciates tradition, and seeks order. That kind of person might also prefer living in a small town nearer to family, going to a church deeply rooted in ritual, celebrating at restaurants they already know and love. Depending on the type of person you are, you might read one of those descriptions as compliment and one as indictment. Don't think of it that way. Society needs lots of different kinds of people, with lots of different kinds of psychologies, to thrive. There are times when a mistrust of outsiders is necessary for a culture to repel a threat. There are times when enthusiasm about change is the only thing standing between a society and stagnation. Open isn't better than closed. Conscientious is a trait, not a compliment. Evolutionarily, the power is in the mix of outlooks, not in any one outlook. That's why this psychological diversity has survived. What is changing is not our psychologies. What is changing is how closely our psychologies map onto our politics and onto a host of other life choices. As the differences between the parties clarify, the magnetic pull of their ideas and demographics becomes stronger to the psychologically aligned, as does their magnetic repulsion to the psychologically opposed. In Price or Pickup, Hetherington and Wyler use a psychological scale they call UID and XED. They write, "People with what we call a XED worldview are more fearful of potential dangers, and are likely to prefer clear and unwavering rules to help them navigate all the threats. This mindset leads them to support social structures in which hierarchy and order prevail, the better to ensure people don't stray too far from the straight and narrow. By contrast, people with what we call a UID worldview are less likely to perceive the world as dangerous. By extension, they will endorse social structures that allow individuals to ND their own way in life. They are more inclined to believe that a society's well-being requires giving people greater latitude to question, to explore, and to discover their authentic selves." 36. In the mid-20th century, this psychological dimension doesn't seem to have split American politics. It's notable, for instance, that opposition to the Vietnam War was evenly distributed across the two parties during the 1960s. As late as 1992, the UID and the XED were nearly identical in which party they chose. Now, though, these psychologies are the dividing line of American politics, at least among white voters. More on why the psychological sort is concentrated among whites, and what it means for politics, later. On the UID side, 71% were Democrats and only 21% were Republicans. On the XED side, 60% were Republicans and only 25% were Democrats. The results are even stronger if you look at ideology. According to Hetherington and Wyler, among the XED, 84% of those who chose one of these two labels chose conservative. Among the UID, 80% of those who chose one of them chose liberal. Every dimension of our lives, ideology, religiosity, geography, and so on, carries a psychological signal. And those psychological signals strengthen as they align. What's been happening to American life is we're taking the magnets and stacking them all on top of one another, so the pull-push force of that stack is multiplied, particularly for the people most engaged in politics. In Open versus Closed, Johnston, Federico, and Lavine tested a variety of psychological tendencies against people's level of interest in politics. What they found, again and again, is psychology doesn't predict political opinions among people who don't pay much attention to politics, but it's a powerful predictor of political opinions among those who do. For the politically disengaged, there is little dispositional sorting, but among the highly engaged, the EX are huge. Different levels of openness to experience can account for as much as 35 percentage point swings. Indiana party identikatyon, overwhelming almost all other factors. These endings led the researchers to an interesting conclusion. In forming an opinion, the question for the unengaged citizen is, what will this policy do for me? Among the engaged, however, reactions to economic issues are better understood as expressively motivated signals of identity. The question for the engaged citizen is, what does support for this policy position say about me? 37. Psychological sorting, in other words, is a powerful driver of identity politics. If you care enough about politics to connect it to your core psychological outlook, then politics becomes part of your psychological self-expression. And as the political coalitions split by psychology, membership in one or the other becomes a clearer signal, both to ourselves and to the world, about who we are and what we value. When we participate in politics to solve a problem, we're participating transactionally. But when we participate in politics to express who we are, that's a signal that politics has become an identity. And that's when our relationship to politics, and to each other, changes. Chapter 3 Your Brain on Groups.